My name is Jim Fergan, the director at the Compass Center Lutheran Organization in downtown Seattle. The title of this particular session is The Causes of Homelessness and the Church's Response to That. And also together with me is...
Nyer, chaplain, sometimes on the streets known as Father Nyer. Most of the time. I can't figure it out. If it's I'm getting old, if I look like Abraham, or what it is. But
what I wanted to do this evening in relationship to homelessness is I wanted to read the account that is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the account of a particular miracle that Jesus performed as he travels about 5 miles from Capernaum, his home, his hometown, and he goes with some of his disciples to the town of Gadara. And when they land there, there is a homeless person. Matthew tells us that there were more than one, that there were two homeless men who had been evicted from the city because of their antics. They were running around nude in the city, frightening people and children and women and the whole thing. And so the city council, the police force, everybody in the city leadership decided that this person or these people could not live in our backyard. So they moved into the caves. And Jesus tells us this story. And it's very, very descriptive. And both Matthew, Mark, and Luke add a little bit more to the description of this man or men. Jesus and his disciples arrived on the other side of the Lake of Galilee in the territory of Gadara. As soon as Jesus got out of the boat, he was met by a man who came out of the burial caves there. This guy was homeless. This man had an evil spirit in him and lived among the tombs. Nobody could keep him tied with chains anymore. Many times his feet and his hands had been tied, but every time he broke the chains and smashed the irons on his feet. He was too strong for anyone to control him. Day and night he wandered among the tombs and through the hills, screaming and cutting himself with stones. He was some distance away when he saw Jesus. So he ran, fell on his knees before him, and screamed in a loud voice, "Jesus, Son of the Most High God, what do you want with me? For God's sake, I beg you, don't punish me." He said this because Jesus was saying, "Evil spirit, come out of this man." And Jesus asked him, "What's your name?" And the man answered, "My name is Mob. There are so many of us." And he kept begging Jesus not to send the evil spirits out of that region. There was a large herd of pigs nearby feeding on the hillside. So the spirits begged Jesus, "Send us into the pigs and let us go into them." He let them go, and the evil spirits went out of the man and entered the pigs. The whole herd, about 2,000 pigs in all, rushed down the side of the cliff into the lake and were drowned. The men who had been taking care of the pigs ran away and spread the news in the town and among the farms. People went out to see what had happened. And when they came to Jesus, they saw the man who used to have the mob of demons in him. He was sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were all afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the man with the demons and about the pigs. So they asked Jesus to leave their territory. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had had the demons begged him, "Let me go with you." And Jesus would not let him. Instead, he told him, "Go back home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how kind he has been to you." So the man left and went through the whole of the 10 towns, telling what Jesus had done for him, and all who heard it were amazed. The reason that I share this story is that I believe that there are homeless people like this today. Severely mentally ill, that we could call some of these people mob or legion. I know a person like this. His name is Bob Lehman. You know Bob? He is one of the sickest of the sick. And Bob is big and strong. And he chews snus. And he's huge. When he comes up to you, he'll say, "Hi, Jim." And I get a tremendous hit on the side of my shoulder. And it hurts. I'm frightened of Bob. Not frightened, but I'm very cautious around Bob Lehman. He has been banned by the bar committee on a number of occasions from the Compass Center because of his inappropriate action and language. Bob is not only mentally ill and belongs in an institution, but he is also chemically dependent. He is an alcoholic and a drug addict. He's what we call a mentally ill, chemically addicted person, a MICA client. And scientists and resource centers and treatment centers still haven't figured out what to do and how to treat the MICA client, the causes of homelessness. And Nair and I wanted to just talk a little bit about this tonight. And I have been at the Compass Center for 14 and a half years. And so I have seen dramatic changes in the makeup of homeless people. And Nair has been working with homeless people for about 17 years or 15, something like that, maybe 20 years. And so together we bring some experience that I think we're able to talk about the causes of homelessness. And the Compass Center, for 75 years, has been an agency of the Lutheran Church that provides a way back home for people, from homelessness back home. And so we have shelter there that is more than just a three huts and a cot. It's a transitional opportunity for people to live over an extended period of time. There are four transitional homes where people can also live for up to 2 years. People who have been on the streets of Seattle and now they're back in a home and working in their particular professional life or whatever that might be. But I wanted to talk about some of the particular reasons for homelessness, and then Nair is going to kind of talk about some examples of how that is. Homeless people, I believe, first of all, can be categorized kind of into three groups of people. And I'd like to suggest that they are the people who have not a home, they don't have health insurance, they don't have a job, and so they are the have-not population. There are people who cannot. The cannot population within the homeless people are people who are either mentally ill or chemically dependent, either late stage alcoholic person. I mean, when these pass outs over here, you saw a slope. This is Jelinek's curve. It was developed about 1972 or 73. By a scientist who has worked in the field of chemical dependency for many, many years and has written various books. But this is a curve of how the disease of alcoholism progresses. It's a progressive disease, and it goes down the slope. And you see that it is divided into three phases as you look at that graph. And the people who are the late stage, or what's called here the chronic phase, are the people who have slid down to the bottom of the slope. These are the people who are on Skid Road or in Pioneer Square in Seattle. Okay, there are people who have been probably using alcohol since maybe 15, 16, 17 years old, and now they're 35, 40, 45, and so it's taken them 20 years to slide down this slope. And that's how long it takes. Okay. If they start at 20 or 21, I want to back up a little bit. If they start at a very young age of 12, 13, 14 in using alcohol, this slope doesn't go down like that. It goes down drastically, almost like you're falling off a cliff. And a youngster or a teenager can become chemically addicted to alcohol within a period of 4 to 6 months. I mean, these are statistics, these are facts that have been discovered, and that's why the United States government protects teenagers from the use of alcohol until they're 21. What is it in Canada? It's also 21? 18. Okay. I wanted just to say that these are the people who are cannot find and stay in a permanent place to live. Mentally ill people cannot move into a permanent house with a permanent job. These are people who cannot do the things that we perceive as public that they should be able to do. We walk by a panhandler in Pioneer Square or in Burien or Ballard around King County, and we say, my goodness, that person looks really normal. Why doesn't he get a job? Most likely, he is a part of the cannot population, and that he has had dozens of jobs and lost them all because of his addiction, okay, or because of mental illness. There is a very small percentage of the homeless people who I think can be categorized as the will not population. They will not move from living on the streets into a place or a shelter or into a permanent home or whatever. But this is a very small percentage. I would suggest that it's less than 5%. But the people who cannot, anywhere from 50 to 60% of the homeless population that we see at the Compass Center in Pioneer Square, I think this is true probably across the country. These are people who cannot, because of mental illness, one of the major causes of homelessness and the problem of chemical dependency. I wanted Nair to just share with us a particular person whom both Nair and I know of, have known a long time. Nair knows him very well, and his name is Eddie, and he lives under the viaduct about a mile south of the Compass Center. And Eddie is a man who we would kind of classify as a bag person. All of his belongings are in two carts. And he is a person who is a will-not homeless person. And he is a beautiful man. Nair?
Yeah, I'm not sure I could classify Eddie, but, you know, that's a possibility. Eddie has been on the streets for, I suppose, about 8-9 years now. And has spent very few days indoors. I think he has a few times when he's been in the hospital. And one time he spent some time at the Bread of Life after getting out of the hospital. But he sleeps outside, he stays outside. He's been shoved around a lot. He used to live over on First Avenue across from the big bookstore, and most of the business people loved him there. He just slept in a thing, but because he always would keep an area where he would stay clean. And a lot of the business would give him a few dollars, and Eddie was an asset to that piece of First Avenue. Well, I could go into a lot of stories, and something happened, and he had to leave there. He ended up back in the alley with the rats, and something else happened. He got shoved out of there. Then he was over by the Compass Center for a while, and some person didn't like him sleeping under where his particular kind of apartment and business was. So he got shoved way down where there wasn't the same kind of protection. And that was much more dangerous. And he has gotten beat up about 3-4 times now. One time almost killed. And Eddie's made some wrong decisions. He's never drank. Doesn't even drink Coke. And I don't think he's ever smoked. But he's made some wrong decisions. But the I suppose the real tragedy that tipped the thing for him was he come across a husband and wife that were fighting, and he intervened, and when the state patrol got there, the knife was in Eddie's hand. And you can imagine what happened. Eddie spent
7 years in prison for being a good Samaritan. I'm not bitter about that, but there's just a lot of things. Now, over the time I've been down there, I've seen Eddie change, and I think become a more beautiful person, a much more beautiful person, primarily because I have a habit of bringing high school and college age kids down on the streets to walk around, and for some reason or other, Eddie has just bonded with these young people, caring and being able to try to talk to them and saying, you know, stay in school. Maybe it's rough with mom and dad right now, but work it out. I mean, don't end up here in the streets. Here's what it's like. And the young people just love Eddie. Just absolutely. But Eddie can't handle going inside a building. He can't eat at the Compass Center. Just too much stuff around. He will come in the chapel once in a while for a short period. So, but he's a person of faith. I don't think he's a Lutheran. He can't quite feel that God, you know, he knows he's going to get into the kingdom and he's going to crawl in on his belly. He'll watch the rest of us kind of skip on in, but that's his view of what's going to happen. And Eddie gives stability to wherever he's at. Protects the cars are safer, people are safer, mm-hmm. The women that walk along the street are safer when Eddie's there.
How old is the man you're talking about?
Eddie would be about 55 in that age. Yeah.
About your age, Buzz?
No. Thank you. Yeah.
Very well read.
Yeah.
As far as current affairs and things like that.
He always has newspapers that he picks up out of the garbage, and maybe a day or two old, but he reads them very, very carefully. He's always got an ear to the street. One of the last conversations I had with him just about a week ago was he was warning me about a big gang-related clash between the Hispanics on one side and the blacks on the other. And it all has to do with the distribution of cocaine or crack in the Pioneer Square area. And it's a turf conflict. To beware of this, Jim. Stay away from this area. I mean, just, you know, this is going to happen. He knew it, you know. So he has a very, very, very careful and a good ear to the streets. And again, how much of it is, reliable gossip or reliable information or not? But I always listen to Eddie, and it's a good day, usually when we can have a conversation. Eddie is an example of a person who has been pushed onto the fringes by circumstances and society, and maybe has a little problem with claustrophobia or whatever it might be. But
and I suppose depression.
Yeah.
People say, why don't you work? Mm-hmm. Well, why work? I mean, when I worked, I had the big house, I had all this, and you know, things were worse then.
Yeah.
And he's depressed with our society.
Yeah, he wants really nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like God put him where he's supposed to be.
Yeah, and that God is using him there.
Sure, using him.
Yeah. In a very special way.
It sounds like he has a lot of insight.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure.
Don't you find that the homeless people, no matter how they got there, whether they're well-known, cannot, move on for whatever reason, but after a certain point, it's a society. And it's a whole community all in itself. And to say, well, why don't they just get out and join the real world or get a job or whatever, it's like saying to a middle-class person, well, why don't you go live some other lifestyle?
That's
because
right.
They understand each other in a way that a great many people, the majority of the people, don't have a clue what it really is like.
Yeah.
And to pass some sort of judgment and say, why don't they do this? Well, maybe they might want to, but in a sense, there's a great many of them that are to some degree comfortable where they are because that's what they know. That's their community, their society, that's their friends. They all understand all that crap that they're all living in.
And some of them aren't going to change that very much until either they see a bunch of their friends die, or things get to the place and they say, I think maybe I'm getting pretty close. This is going to kill me. That's when you have an opportunity to maybe do something.
Yeah. And it's amazing, I guess, how much you can live with and sort of be comfortable with, I mean, in terms of the conditions or lack of, and not really be aware how bad it might be, or how
what you're missing.
But see, what we don't see is sometimes how good it is to be around people that care. I mean, it's rough. It's rough being alcoholic, and it's rough being homeless. But they see other things, and where they might be able to move. And especially getting $5-6 an hour is a little spot all by themselves, you know, up on Capitol Hill or someplace. If they could get a job making $10 an hour, $12 an hour, so they could have some of the niceties, it might be a little different.
That's for sure, because if you get a job, I mean, then at least in all the other kinds of problems, as far as, you know, you get a job for minimum wage or whatever and get some small amount of money, well then you're into the other problems and you use that small amount of money to go buy drugs or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then you get hooked into the whole drug using and then also a dealing. And it's not just the dealer and the user. There are about four layers in between the dealer who in there, there's the runner and the spotter and so forth and so on. So that each one has a part of the cut and that becomes their job their source of income and their source of continued progression in the nature of the dependency. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the greatest struggles that we face today in providing services to homeless people is that there are so many facets to this particular community of homeless people. So many, and 75 years ago when the Compass Center started, there were basically people who were unemployed, not underemployed, but they were, you know, the loggers. They all of a sudden lost their job in the one logging company, and it took them a little while to get another job, and sailors who were coming in and so forth and so on. And maybe one or two or three or just a few late-stage alcoholic people that they usually ended up in the drunk tank and then back out in the streets and so forth and so on. But today's homeless population has many, many different problems that they bring with them. And it's real important to be able to, I think, sort all of that out for each particular individual through the provision of counselors, through the provision of a place where they can be also spiritually touched and healed, which is a real important part of what Nair and his staff does. And he has a staff of actually two other chaplains and then many volunteers that he works with and trains and so forth. So that it's just a major component just to provide the physical needs of transitional housing or clothes or food or banking service or postal address. These are all things that the agency does are all important, but you have to have also the spiritual component that's there. Then the whole person is being treated. One of the great tragedies that we see consistently is the large number of mentally ill people.
That's right.
For whom services are almost non-existent, and for whom family is non-existent, and for whom institutions are non-existent. And we see them all over where they sit and babble and talk to not strangers, but they talk to themselves. They talk to imaginary, to us we would call them imaginary, but to them they're real people. and real visions or whatever it might be.
I think there too, it's you know, we can learn a lot by looking at the New Testament again, mm-hmm. because a lot of this is that sometimes the most simple acts of kindness can help people that are mentally ill. And maybe even some things happen so that they're more apt to stay on their meds and things like that. I think just a week ago I was walking to the ferry and here was this young man. And he was sitting there and he just looked great. And he was with a girlfriend and she looked great. And he grabbed me and he said, "Hey, I just want to thank you, Pastor." I said, "For what?" "Well, I've known him off and on for the last 10 years, I suppose, and sometimes he's been a real problem and, you know, does strange things." And he says, "Well, because you were on the bus." He says, "I was just about losing it." That was about mm-hmm. 5-6 months ago. And he said, "You just your being there." Now, I think of one other lady who, this is before I was at the Compass Center, came down to my parish and I thought I was supposed to talk to her. She wanted to talk to me. And we went for an hour, and I wasn't able to say a thing. I mean, she just kept going and going. And I was so exhausted when I got through, and I thought, she left? Boy, am I, what am I, a friend, a pastor? I didn't say a thing. I don't even think I said goodbye to her. The next day, she walks 3 miles. She's just as clear as can be. She says, "I just had to come back and thank you for what you did for me yesterday."
You listen.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right. And one of the things in the listening, it's important to sit next to them, not opposite where you are eye to eye, but just to sit next to them and not too close, not at the beginning. But you learn all kinds of ways in which you can touch the lives of the mentally ill just by, sometimes just maybe sitting the way in which they sit,
right.
Crossing the legs the way in which they sit, you see. I've known Louis Ekberg for 14 and a half years. And when I first knew Louis was a bag person with a different kind of perspective, and many of them have different things. But Louis's thing was to consistently save jackets and sweaters and clothes and socks. And he would have on, at any time of the day or the season, he would have on anywhere from, 20 to 30 socks. Not just on his feet, but he would have a t-shirt on and he'd have socks pinned on his t-shirt and then a sweater and then socks pinned on his sweater all over and then a jacket and then a heavier jacket and he'd wear two or three pair of pants. But Louis' thing, and he would never talk to anyone. He wandered the streets by night and by day he would sit in our day room at the Compass Center and just kind of sit there with all of these clothes on, and it would just kind of prop him up and he would just sit there and sleep. And there were many occasions when I went over and I just sat next to him. Just sat next to him. And just like that, like he sat. And pretty soon Louis wanted to know my name. And I shared my name. And I knew who he was because he got, he used to work over at the Pinhile Mission. Mm-hmm. It was over there on by Occidental Park.
Yep.
But Louis just finally began to talk, and I got him connected up with the Harborview Hospital's psychiatric clinic over at the Pioneer Square Health Station. They got him on Prolixin, which is a real powerful drug, and he wasn't really, so every week they would give him a shot. But I was able to get him convinced that this was the healthiest thing for him. Today, Louis lives in the Fry Hotel, and he maintains himself. He's one of the protective payees for whom we provide cash maintenance and cash monitoring and money, proper money use, or and so forth and so on, at the Compass Center. But Louis has worked various times at the Compass Center in our food services program as a janitor. But as soon as you put too much on him, you expect too much. Crash. Finished. And he takes his medication now, but every once in a while, it seems he also goes out and buys some marijuana, and he smokes that. And that throws off his medication, and he becomes somewhat dysfunctional. See, and that's one of the dangers of the mentally ill people, is that they really need to live in a kind of a halfway house where they can be cared for by a mental health professional to see to it that their meds are taken at the proper time, and then also that they find meaning, help them to find meaning for their lives. For Louis just to live in his own little single resident occupancy room at the Fry Hotel is not a healthy thing. He needs community. So every day he comes to the Compass Center, and that's kind of his community. But he doesn't live there, but he lives in a hotel about a block and a half away. So the mentally ill people have a great deal of suffering that they experience because of the homelessness. Maybe you could just share a little bit about how this, I think that this all happened. In the early 70s, the deinstitutionalization of the mental hospitals began. And they closed down, and over a period of about 5 or 6 years, there were, I don't know, something like 250 or 300,000 patients in the mental hospitals, and then they just closed them all down to 50 or 60,000 within a period of about 5 or 6 years. Now, the reason that they were, the government perceived that these mental institutions could be closed was at the same time the discovery of many mood-altering drugs. That were all prescriptive drugs. The person who was very, very hyperactive and mentally ill because of this hyperactivity, and their brain cells go back and forth really, really fast. And these people get the schizophrenic shakes and so forth and so on. They're very, very hyper. Well, there are medications that can take that person and bring them down to be much, much more neutral or normal, let's say. What's normal? You know, whatever. But anyway, the same way the people who were very, very depressed, there are medications that can be used that are antidepressant medications that help people come up here and live in the more of the normal range. But unfortunately, those medications must be taken every day for the rest of the person's life. And while they're on those very powerful drugs, you cannot add another mood-altering drug into the system like alcohol or marijuana or some of the other drugs that are available. If you do, there'd be a tremendous imbalance is created, and the person becomes sicker than it was before. And unfortunately, to prevent all of this from happening, the federal government and the state governments in the mental health arena had hoped to be able to develop halfway houses that would take the deinstitutionalized people, medicated people, and have them live in halfway houses where they would be then provided with professional mental health care, and also then an opportunity to live a healthy, normal life. And there would be 10 to 15 people living in these homes, and they would be located in neighborhoods. Well, there was lots and lots of opposition to this from neighborhoods. There was not enough money to carry through, and then the 80s came, and lots of things changed as far as mental health and all the other things that were there for helping people who had problems. And so they have ended up on the streets, and that's where they stayed. And that's where they have multiplied.
Is it still true that our jail, King County Jail,
that's
is
right.
the third largest mental facility in the state?
Yep. The seventh Tragic. Floor of the King County Jail is that's where where a lot of the men. Bob Lehman has been there at least a half a dozen times in and out, because and you can't even hardly keep chains on him. That's why when I read this story of this man by the name of Mob or Legion from Gadara, I think of Bob Lehman.
And he's one of the, in a sense, happiest, lovable guys.
Oh yeah.
And I, you know. But I'm scared when I get close. Not that he's going to be mean, but just his hand moves quick.
Yeah.
That and I could, just, you know, a jaw could be gone.
Oh yeah.
Really
oh, yeah.
quickly.
Yeah. No, he has actually come on me from the back.
Yeah.
And a couple of other our staff there, they were there to protect me and so forth. Anyway, that's one of the causes of homelessness. And when mentally ill people do come to the Compass Center, we help them to get in touch with the Community Psychiatric Clinic or the Harborview Hospital Mental Health section at the hospital, and also with mental health professionals who are connected with the clinic in Pioneer Square. I wanted to just also to share with you some of the another major cause of homelessness is the use of alcohol and drugs. This is probably the other major change or shift that we've seen in Pioneer Square in working with homeless people, is that previous to, let's say, 91 or 90, it was almost always alcohol-related problems as far as chemical dependency is concerned. And I just wanted to again point out that graph, the progressive nature of the disease of alcoholism. And how many of you know somebody who's has a problem with alcohol? And just about all of the hands go up. I want, just for your own information, as you look at this graph, what we call the stages of alcoholism and the progressive nature in it. It will progress. That's an absolute. Okay? It will. Now, the early stages, as you read the various, in this little graph, you can read the problems that are experienced by people who use alcohol. 60% of the people who suffer from alcoholism in America, and that number is put at between 20 and 25 million people, okay, very large number of people. 60% of those people are at this early stage, okay? That's a lot. Now, they are going to progress. There's just no doubt about that. The next stage is what we call the crucial phase, or the middle stage. There you have 20% of the, let's say, 20 million Americans who fall into that category because of the various symptoms that are there in their lives and in their drinking patterns. The next stage is what we call the late stage, and there you have 16% of the people who have slipped down into that real dark area where the chronic is. And finally, you have the chronic or late stage of the disease. And of the 20 million people in America, only 4% of these people, 4% are down here at the bottom. Okay. Others, as they slip down there, they either end up in the cemetery, or they end up in jail, or they end up, they've reached their bottom, and they go from the crucial stage, and then somebody has come with an intervention, people who really love and care about that person, and say, you're going to go into treatment. And so then the person in this crucial stage can come over here. You can cross over at any time. And then with the help of AA, you can live a normal life. In other words, that crossover time doesn't have to go down here. You can, your bottom, the person's bottom can be up here somewhere, and then the slope goes up. And then all of the necessary symptoms of wellness are also there and experienced by people. It's really a very helpful tool. And at the same time, at the backside, you have the helpful tool for the family. Those of you who have loved ones, friends whom you really care about, parishioners that you care about, then it's real important for you to also be able to be a part of this. Alcoholism, drug dependency is a major cause, not only for homelessness, but also for the victims of domestic violence. And so often, it is, that's the reason why the women whom we provide services to at the Compass Center, about 85 to 90% of the women that come there for shelter, for transition, and for the services that they need, about 80 to 85% of them are victims of domestic violence, almost always connected with alcohol and drug use. And so there's a big connection there. Any questions around some of the causes? Chemical dependency. There's also the cocaine thing over mm-hmm. there. I wanted just to point that out to you. They're very, very similar, the progressive nature of cocaine dependency. And again, when you take the white powder, which is cocaine, and you turn that into crack, and that's something that comes in a little tiny rock about the size of your little fingernail, if your fingernail is small. And those little rocks sell for about $20 down in Pioneer Square. And then the rock can be kind of chipped off. You can take the rock, and it's a crystal, and you can kind of just get flakes of it and put it in your little pipe. And you have to have a little pipe. And then, of course, you smoke that. There's a little tiny screen at the bottom of the pipe. And the little crystals sit in that the top of the screen, and you just take that in, and the smoke from those few little flakes go directly to the lungs, of course, and then within about 5 or 10 seconds, it's in the brain, and the brain waves are immensely impacted by this drug, and that crack cocaine gives a very, very quick hit of a very powerful high. And people who are, again, in the normal range of activity, all of a sudden with this hit of crack, they go way up here, and they really can become hyper, and they see things, and they can do things that they've never done before. And they're up there for probably 20 minutes to a half an hour. And then what goes up also comes down. But when you come down, you don't come down here to where you were before, you bounce. And it's like a roller coaster. See? And so you're coming down like this, and when you're down here, you're really feeling very depressed, and you're looking for just some kind of way to get back up here and to experience that high again. And so you become, the crack addict becomes not so much addicted to the drug as addicted to the mood, the altered mood that has been up here. Okay. There, one of the other drugs, so this has become the drug of choice among many poor people, among many homeless people. And unfortunately, the dealers also know that. And so dealers will use their sub-dealers in the Pioneer Square area in order to sell this kind of stuff to homeless people. And then homeless people, in order to get their funds, in order to buy the crack, they will serve as runners and as spotters for the sub-dealers. Okay. So it's kind of a bureaucracy. The main dealers come from Capitol Hill or Queen Anne Hill or Bellevue or outside of the downtown core. And these big dealers that carry the crack with them, anywhere from, you know, let's say 20 to 40 or 50 rocks, they'll come in to the Pioneer Square area at usually 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And then they pass off these crack, these rocks to the sub-dealers. And there may be anywhere from 10 to 15 sub-dealers that one dealer supplies. And then each sub-dealer, he'll have maybe 10 rocks or 5. And each one of those is worth $20. But in order for him to pass those or sell them to the user in a very safe way, he's got to hire a spotter and a runner. There's a runner on one corner who's always looking for the police. So it's a real intricate kind of an enmeshed group of people. And I've come to know quite a bit about this. Nair hasn't had that opportunity, but at the Compass Center, we've had a couple of drug buy bust operations that have taken place within the agency. In our hygiene center, one of the services the agency provides to homeless people is a place where they can go for toilets and showers and laundry services and free clothing distribution. And it's open there for everyone. We do not use drug sniffing dogs, or we don't have a search policy for homeless people. And we provide free shaves also for people, you know, that might... Don, free shapes, and Buzz, I mean, haircuts too. Anyway,
it meant for us to be, like that.
We're divided. But this is an absolute essential service for homeless people. But when you, we will not have video cameras in the men's shower room, or in the toilets where people sit down and do their stuff. It's real important for them to go in there and to experience a little bit of privacy and dignity. Now, when two people get caught in there and they're making a deal by an undercover narcotics agent, it's a big deal because it's a homeless shelter. You see, and there's a lot of people in the community that want the shelter closed and out of the area. So the community has gotten up in arms, has threatened the Compass Center with a civil nuisance suit, which could close up the services, you see. And so we're put on the spot, and we are forced to make sure that that does not ever happen again. You see, well, you can't, I mean, this is impossible. We're caught, and so it's real important to be able to interact with the downtown community, with the community police team, with the anti-crime team, with the narcotics department, and with the mayor's office, and with the Department of Housing and Human Services, and with United Way, and with the bishop's office. And so it's a juggling act.
Operations
no.
In Pioneer Square
applying
with that?
No. The other missions, there are two other main missions down there. One is the Bread of Life mission and one is the Union Gospel mission. And both of them operate on a different philosophy. People are allowed to come into their place under the condition that they will go through a religious hoop, for one thing. And when they enter the building for their shelter night, they are in there under a chaplain's care throughout the night at the Union Gospel Mission and at the Bread of Life Mission. Okay, so that and not everybody is allowed to come in there. Only the people who are in the program, and you're either in the program, and the program means a particular Bible study program, or you're not in the program. Now that's the way it's operated there. The Union Gospel Mission does have a place where people can go to the bathroom and use a shower. But there is always, always a person in that, an attendant behind a kind of a fort in the lobby where the people are sitting and waiting to use a shower. And then the person who goes in to take the shower is kind of watched while he is taking a shower. Now, we are going to institute some much more monitoring program, or do a lot more serious monitoring of homeless people as they use that particular hygiene center. We have to, because we cannot let this happen again. So anyway, working with people homeless who are chemically dependent is a very, very difficult and challenging opportunity to minister to people who are sick. Okay? This is a disease. These are not bad people. They are not the lepers of our society or the untouchables. But they are the people who are experiencing a very serious illness that has progressed to the, sometimes to the very bottom. And it behooves us as members of the church certainly to reach out and to bring healing and wholeness and hope. Yes, please.
A portion of that is dedicated to Mary Witt.
The Mary Witt Home is a home for six, let me just to share with you, for those of you who don't know Mary Witt, Elmer Witt at one time was the director up here, and Mary worked up here at Holden Village also with the former director. And Mary left Holden Village and came to work at the Compass Center as a counselor in the women's program from 1989, 1990 to about 1992. For 2.5 years, Mary worked there and had a tremendous impact on the women's program at the Lutheran Compass Center. Mary died very suddenly in an automobile accident on her way to Billings, Montana, driving from Seattle. And it was a great tragedy and a great loss to the Compass Center and, of course, to many, many people whom Mary's life had touched. When we bought a home for six women in recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction, we called the home the Mary Witt Home. And it's located up in the Lake City area of north of Seattle a little bit, and it's a very, very beautiful home that has six bedrooms in that home. The main bedroom in the top floor has a jacuzzi bathtub in it, and it's just a marvelous home. We bought that home for about $200,000 about three years ago, and then we put another $50,000 into it in renovating it, and then we had lots and lots of opposition from the neighborhood when we bought that home, and finally, after a lot of litigation, after 2 years of litigation, actually, we were able to fill it up and go forward. But one of the neighbors, it had never been proven, of course, tried to torch the home, and it was about $30,000 worth of damage, which the insurance covered just before we moved in. So when you locate a home like this, but the Mary Witt Home is one of four transitional homes that the Compass Center owns. And right now we're looking for another home, a fifth home, to be able to purchase hopefully by the end of November. And we want to expand this particular program because it takes people off the streets, gets them into the detoxification center, and from the detox center through the assessment center and a couple of other hoops, but gets them into treatment, an inpatient treatment center out in Cedar Hills, which is about 30 miles from Seattle. And there they spend 30 to 60 days inpatient. And then after they have finished that program of inpatient treatment, they do not recycle back to Pioneer Square, but they move into a home, a beautiful home in a dignified and nice community, and that's where they can live up to 2 years. And that's what breaks the cycle of chemical dependency and homelessness. When you are willing to invest time and prayer and love and, of course, money into a person that really then is able to help himself or herself get out of this crisis of homelessness.
Are they all there voluntarily?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it's a home with tremendous dignity. Now, there's real structure there. The six women who live in the Mary Witt Home, if any one of them was suspected of using drugs or alcohol, immediate, within the hour, eviction. And they know that. And a woman who is a recovering woman herself can't be conned. And when there are five other women and one woman in the six is trying to do something that's out of line, and then they have to go to three AA or NA meetings a week. They've got to be involved in a new life and wellness, each of them. And this is true of the other two homes for men and one other home for women. It's a very successful program. Yeah, Don?
This morning we were talking about Drink to the World, or World Hunger Session.
Yeah.
One of the things that was always talked about is that the rich and the poor should meet one.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So what do you do in your program to kind of help that, so that people are not just sort of purveyors of money, but also mm-hmm. are able to in some ways come and meet other people and thus take away a lot of that kind of fear and anxiety about...
Sure.
Which you're also trying to...
Sure. NIAR has a great deal to do with that program of the rich and the poor having an opportunity to meet one another.
And almost, especially through the winter, not quite as much during the summer, but then too. One of the things is because a church group comes in and does the meal on Wednesday nights. And we try, and most of the time I think succeed, of having at least some of the people that are serving come down and become a part of the little Eucharistic service in our little chapel. So you have the rich people and the street people together. And it's not Sunday, and it's not, it's us. So we can kind of do what we want, and as long as we have the gospel proclaimed and the sacrament, why, we can be Lutheran, you know. So for the past, 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose 95% of the time our confessional service is done by an old Indian who comes in and he just loves to pray, and he lights the sweet grass and he maybe chants a little bit and maybe explains to people that aren't aware, and then he goes around and smudges everyone. Well, in the the Native American tradition, kind of like our Vesper service, you know, let our prayer rise before you as incense. When the smudging is happening, you are offering your hurts, the hurts of the world, you know, any hurt that's there, up to God and receiving the blessing of God. And then maybe we look for a moment at the crucifix, a beautiful carved crucifix, and there's a lot of sharing and some singing. Sometimes we do well. Sometimes there's musical groups. And there's always the Eucharist. Sometimes the Eucharist is an after service because things happen and it becomes explosive and people go out and, you know, we never know what's going to happen. But they find their way back in and we find a way to reconcile, and old George will say, Indian George, you know, Pastor, I think we can have the Eucharist now. You know, we settle. And it's terribly powerful, especially for the young people that come down, but also for adults. Let me just tell you one other little quick story. I think we're off there. No, or might be. One of the happiest, most beautiful, saintly alcoholics that I've known, for 5 years, either slept on one of the doorways going to the ferry or would take the ferry over and sleep under the ramp. But his mission to greet people as they came off the ferry, like, you know, a couple thousand or 5,000, and on the way back, he died about a month ago. And I think he got more publicity than the mayor of the city would have gotten. The TV station came over to our island and they spent 7 hours over there doing a thing after our service to get that on the... Well, this is just one little illustration. Some people would walk by this happy hobo and, you know, be mad because he wasn't working.